Hello, everyone, and welcome to Some Zero Headlines. This is Avery Pagan. On this podcast, we showcase active investors and their best ideas, plucked straight from the Some Zero community. Today, a look at the world of emerging markets investing with Ben Griffith of Miri Capital Management. Most investors shy away from opaque markets like Poland, Turkey, Bangladesh, or they move into these regions once they've built expertise in the developed world. But these markets are where Griffith cut his teeth. Employing his own brand of friendly activism, Griffith sets his portfolio companies on a path to improve international visibility, streamline operations, and ultimately re-rate their market value. Oftentimes, the process is shockingly simple. Translate company reporting into English, correct a misleading GICS classification. Where other investors might see deficiencies, Griffith sees misunderstood value. With that, I'd like to welcome our featured guest, Ben Griffith.
Ben, great to have you on Some Zero. You've been one of our most prolific members since 2016, and you are an emerging markets pro. And I think this is a super interesting topic because, at least for us here in the US, I think we tend to be a little narrow-minded on sort of the broader investing horizon and how EM should play into people's portfolios. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you kind of got started in EM and how you launched Miri?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and thank you very much for having me. So basically, I got into this world of smaller emerging markets in part for a personal reason. My wife is actually from Ecuador and I speak Spanish to some degree and spent some time in Peru in college. My first job out of school was actually working for Bloomberg in the Latin American Equity Data Group, which was really translating, collecting, and adjusting accounting for financial statements to drive the data you see in Bloomberg, which, you know, in that early part of my career definitely tuned me into the fact that, you know, how the data from these smaller emerging market companies filters through or doesn't filter through to market participants sometimes can drive valuations and efficiency just as much as what the data is itself. So, you know, in that early part of my career out of school, I saw that, you know, companies with no English reporting, with no data on Bloomberg, with no sell-side research coverage, often had more wild, I would say, rather than always being cheaper, they tended to have more wild valuations than what you would expect for that business. So some were very expensive and some were very cheap, but definitely a low level of efficiency. And I actually reached out kind of early in my career. I think I was 24 years old and reached out to Cliff Quisenberry, who had run the Parametric and Eaton Vance emerging markets. EITX is the fund. And we actually joined in, you know, with brilliant timing in August 2008 to launch a frontier markets fund at Caravan Capital Management, where, you know, as this junior stock picker, I was sent out to go and meet with potential portfolio companies in places like Kenya and Bangladesh and Estonia and Panama, yeah. And, you know, a lot of very, very early stage countries. And that's, you know, so I was essentially filling country buckets by meeting with companies and selecting stocks within this globally diversified frontier markets portfolio.
And can you just help define the line between frontier markets and EM?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult thing to do, and everybody sort of does it differently. I actually have sort of come to the view that it doesn't make sense from an allocation standpoint to try to draw a line. But, you know, the typical MSCI sort of definition is really driven by size, country size, and liquidity. So regardless of income levels, smaller equity markets tend to be frontier markets. Frontier has really been a very difficult space, which, you know, I could certainly get into, but there were a number of frontier funds like Caravan that launched in that probably 06 to 2014 period. And there's been, you know, dramatic outflows out of the space since then. And for me personally, frontier was really my learning grounds where learn to pick stocks, which I do think is a bit unique. You know, most investors, I would say their background is in developed markets, and then they kind of apply what they learned there to emerging markets. Yeah. I kind of started in Bangladesh and have sort of moved up to increasingly more developed markets over time. But it was a great learning grounds, you know, particularly for this activist approach. You know, traveling to those kind of markets in the first couple of years of Caravan, we found that it was not difficult to identify quality businesses, especially in the lower end of the cap spectrum, that were dramatically undervalued relative to what those businesses would trade at in more developed markets. What was difficult was to get the markets to recognize that value. Right. So easy to find quality, cheap companies, very difficult to get good returns out of those quality, cheap companies. And that's really what gave birth to this friendly activism thing that has evolved today in what we call the MIRI strategy, because we have sort of learned over the years to engage with often family owners of these businesses to get them to improve reporting, IR, sometimes governance, sometimes capital allocation, to both unlock value actively, but also to get the markets to recognize the value in what's often sort of obfuscated value.
So what countries are represented in your portfolio today? And what would you say is sort of like the average market cap of your typical portfolio company?
Yeah, well, and it's definitely evolved over the years. So in that early years of Caravan, we really learned how to do some really basic activism. And then in the 2015 on period, we launched a standalone strategy for MIRI that was a highly concentrated portfolio. And from that 2015 period to, I'd say, about 2018-19, we really learned where we find this friendly engagement approach working and that it's repeatable. And those markets where it's very difficult. Today, it's predominantly emerging markets, micro and small cap. So the approach we've found works well in these very broad equity markets, countries like Poland, Korea, Taiwan, in general, Europe and Asia, although we do certainly find opportunities in countries around the world. But when you have these really broad equity markets, with a lot of liquid microcaps, that's where we're able to kind of uncover hidden value and then actively work with companies to get them discovered.
And how small will you go? I mean, are you investing in companies that are 100 million market cap and or lower, or are they typically between 100 and a billion? What's the sweet spot?
Yeah, our current average is about 200 million, and that's pretty typical. We often will, I mean, we'll look at companies sub 50 million in market cap, although that's, you know, that's more rare. Uh-huh. And we're generally not looking above a billion in market cap. I find that this opportunity to invest in good businesses that don't have an IR person, that don't have English language reporting, that don't have a formal dividend policy, that opportunity doesn't really exist above, say, a billion in market cap in general.
So when you're screening for companies, if you could summarize what that screen looks like, I'm sure there's a valuation component to it, but what else kind of hits at the activist friendly component?
You know, we ultimately found that this approach works well with companies that have the highest possible delta between their valuation and international comps. And we also find it's easier to engage as activists with technology, healthcare, and consumer and asset light industrial companies. You know, they tend to be internationally educated, younger management teams, more kind of international strategic, you know, conversations that those industries are open to, as opposed to kind of more government and commodity driven type businesses that you find in other sectors. So we're looking in those sectors that we find that like highest potential delta. We love miscategorized things. And a lot of what we do, I think, is really fixing cases of misbucketing. Uh-huh. So we love to find businesses with ROIC or growth that's too high, quote unquote, for the business it's in. So say, you know, an IT distributor, according to S&P GICS, that's always generating an ROIC over 20% and has high margins. You say, well, maybe it's actually not a distributor, maybe it's misclassified, and really it's an IT service company with a lot of proprietary bolt-ons, right? So it's, we love those cases where the market misunderstands what the business actually is, and we could help fix that.
And how do you get over, from a governance standpoint, knowing which companies care about the minority shareholder versus those that don't, especially for these smaller cap, you know, kind of family run companies?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really a core part of what we do to invest in companies at very low multiples in that are there in part because maybe there are concerns about capital allocation, investor friendliness, where we can get in and encourage the company to do things that prove to the market that they are aligned with shareholders. So, you know, a lot of the recommendations we're making are around formalizing dividend policies, communicating those better to the market, oftentimes increasing cash dividends, share buyback programs, non-core asset sales. And we find that, you know, companies where they can demonstrate a real improvement in those areas are apt to achieve a re-rating and evaluation.
And are you finding that for the most part, your level of access to the C-suite of these companies is fairly straightforward? I mean, or is it difficult getting that conversation going?
Yeah. I think we've learned to sort of let this mutual filtration process happen during the diligence that we do. So, you know, if we're going on a trip, and a lot of it revolves around the travel, certainly pre-COVID, and I'm hoping here shortly post-COVID. You know, so if there's from the desk work, say 10 companies in Bangladesh or Poland, you know, at one point in time that look really attractive from our screening and some initial desk work, we'll reach out to them and maybe only five of them will agree to meet with us. We've kind of learned not to fight that too hard, right? It's an early signal in terms of their likelihood of improving reporting in English and going on a roadshow if they're not even willing to meet with me when I come to Warsaw,
let's say. Yeah. Are you typically hiring any kind of local analyst or local expertise on the ground to channel check a company, kind of once you maybe get to that stage where there is a conversation going?
So, well, we typically do that work in country, but we're not hiring people to do it generally. We do speak with certainly local brokers, analysts, and other contacts from the network we've built. And there's probably 5 or 10 countries now where we find this approach to be really repeatable. And that's where we've kind of built out the largest networks, I would say. And then a lot of the typical channel checks we'll do when we're traveling, which certainly we could talk a bit about COVID because it certainly changed things. But that's typically how we do what we do.
Are these companies typically reporting in English?
So a lot of them don't. And that's actually one of our favorite deficiencies to fix, I would say, because it is fairly straight. Yeah, it can be easy. You know, we really traffic in terrible Google translation, you know, comically bad Google Translate examples. And, you know, we've learned which languages Google Translate better than others. We should probably reach out to Google and help them
right.
identifying that. We start with Google Translate. Sometimes that works better than others. In those markets where that really doesn't work very well, we'll very quickly reach out to management and ask them to simply translate, say, the annual report. But we do find that, I mean, to a large extent, what we're doing is investing in good businesses that are difficult for foreigners to recognize that they're good businesses. And then we want to fix that to make it really easy for the next investors to see that it's a good business, right? By getting them to report in English, expanding the company presentation, providing guidance for the first time, et cetera, right? So it really, whereas a lot of our peers would move on to the next one if they don't find those things, to us, those deficiencies are all opportunities.
Right. And in some of your research, you talk about the local retail investors in these emerging markets, maybe not, you know, being super sophisticated. You know, they're for the most part trading on their own accounts. So there's a PR challenge there that you've got to get over, or that those companies have to get over in order to re-rate. I mean, how do you build that narrative for, I don't know, the typical Polish investor looking at the Polish stock market?
Yeah, no, it is for the most part coaching and convincing the company to improve their own reporting and investor relations, to expand the reporting, to expand segment reporting, produce the first company presentation, do it in English, have guidance. We can do some of the database work on our end to reach out to GICS to fix the classification. We love it when the errors are unfavorable, right? So when Bloomberg makes it look like it's at 20 times and it's a telco and actually it's a software company at 3 times, that's
right.
So we love to fix those kind of errors ourselves. And we do find that the retail investors, it helps to attract more attention to the company, frankly, when we get involved, right? So when we cross 5% in a company and publicly disclose as per the rules in most of our markets, when that comes in conjunction with, say, a history of these companies improving reporting, governance, et cetera, then oftentimes the retail investors will kind of react to our involvement, which is, helpful in terms of helping the company, get discovered by larger investors as well.
And does ESG kind of come into play as well from a marketing standpoint?
Just touching on ESG, throughout our history, we've had the luxury as a small firm to only invest in companies where we're personally comfortable with what we see and the people involved and personally care about sustainability. And we also, of course, have, in terms of our policy restrictions, we don't invest in extractive industries, oil and gas, mining. We don't invest in tobacco or weapons makers. In terms of what we do invest in, as I mentioned, we find the approach tends to work really well in businesses that I think align really well with the sustainable development goals, technology, healthcare, low-income consumer. And then we are, as activists, encouraging these companies to improve. It just aligns well because we're already making, say, 10 recommendations in terms of ways to unlock or improve recognition of value. So it's easier having that relationship and already being in that process to make recommendations about environment and social impact. Some of the typical ENS goals we find are very easy to universally push for in our markets. One of them is board diversity. Shockingly, women are about 50% of the population in every country in the world. And it's very difficult, I think, for anybody to argue that there aren't, numerous highly qualified women to be on boards in every country in the world. And yet, in the smaller companies especially, they are, of course, predominantly men, even more so than you find in larger cap companies, right? So some of those recommendations that we make universally, and there's others that I would say are more tailored to kind of the relevance in those businesses.
That makes sense. One thing that you've mentioned in your research is that friendly activism is a pretty small universe of funds. Can you quantify that? Like, how many folks are doing what you're doing in the markets that you're addressing?
Yeah, different people have different definitions, and there's certainly managers that will do this. I've seen on a more ad hoc basis where when they find the opportunity, they will engage. But in terms of funds where this is their bread and butter, every single portfolio company, the activism is a key part of the thesis, I really find about three managers that are doing this in the world. And it's basically, I would say, us within the smallest cap spectrum, the sub 250 million market cap, where we frankly, it's a smaller universe, but we find, or a smaller potential capacity, but we find probably the greatest opportunity. And then there's Kabouter and Kartika are certainly, larger than us. Kartika, I think, has, the longest track record, I think, of anyone dedicated to friendly activism in emerging markets. And it's quite a good track record. And so there's a very small club of us that are engaging in a dedicated way in emerging markets. But, it's, as a group, we've performed very well. And I do see kind of the future of active management in emerging and inefficient markets being in activism in some form.
Great. So let's go through a few case studies. You've written about CIR, SPA on SumZero. Let's talk about that. I'd be curious how how did you screen for it? What was its valuation when it first piqued your interest? And what were you able to do to
to get that company to re-rate
nursing? Yeah, it's called CHEER in Italy. It's a family holding company led by the De Benedetti group that has frankly moved the ball forward, you know, very significantly in terms of streamlining from this very almost discombobulated, you could say, holding company down to two assets today, two operating assets. And those are a rather small auto parts maker and also the largest long-term care facility nursing home chain in Italy.
What's the market cap?
I'll just pull it up quickly here. It's about $750 today.
Got it.
And it's, you know, of the kind of two types, say the streamlined discovery plays versus the holding companies, this is definitely, you know, a holding company with similar, I would say, market misperceptions. The combination of the businesses in some ways makes it more difficult to analyze the real value. We find that the vast majority of the value comes from the nursing home chain, which is, you know, a growth business in Europe. It's a beloved business. If you look at Corian and Orpea, the comps in Europe are trading at 12 to 13 times adjusted EBITDA. And we see this one with a very large cash pile at the holdco level at around 3 times EBITDA. Some assumptions on post bounce back from COVID, because it's certainly been a COVID directly impacted business. And, you know, so this is a case where I see ourselves as more getting involved with a company that's already moving in the right direction and helping where we can to get the markets to recognize the value prior to a sort of full restructuring, which I do think this one has the potential in the medium term to sell off the auto parts business or spin it out. I think there's different ways of potentially restructuring, but ultimately, the markets will best recognize the value in our view when the CHEER becomes kind of a streamlined healthcare business. It's interesting in this world, the degree to which the markets are discounting holdcos is really extreme. I would say certainly beyond what makes fundamental sense.
But at 3 times EBITDA, I mean, you think of CHEER as a 4x, 3x, like what's your target for this?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we think that the nursing home chain deserves to trade in line with the peers, which would be a 3-4x on that, you know, EBITDA. The auto parts business actually has its own separate listing. Our view is that market valuation is low as well. And then on top of that, you get a, you know, very large cash and investment pile at the holdco level. IFRS 16 definitely makes this business and the combination more difficult to analyze and understand. You know, we think they're certainly moving in the right direction, both in terms of structure. They actually sold off last year a print publishing and radio business, going from 3 separate operating companies down to 2. It merged 2 holding companies of the same assets, the same businesses as well. And they've definitely expanded reporting and IR in terms of costs, which is the nursing home business. So it's definitely been moving in the right direction in our view, and we think it will continue. And that last leg of potential catalyst, we think, is what could have the greatest market reaction.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Definitely sounds interesting. What is the, like, for a U.S. investor to actually invest in any of these names, what would they have to do?
As we've sort of moved up the market development spectrum, as, you know, CHEER is in Italy, you know, it's certainly easier in some of our more developed markets, Europe, Japan, et cetera, to access via some of these retail brokerages. You know, not that we'd sort of recommend people to dabble in stocks and other markets without coverage, but you can certainly access it in those ways. We do find kind of the local retail and the foreign institutional investors being kind of the marginal buyer when we get involved.
Yeah.
So there's sort of the holdco type plays like CHEER. Frankly, you know, and I think it'll surprise no one that our more lucrative investments have tended to be the smaller streamlined companies that don't need significant restructuring to unlock value, but simply are not telling a story at all and are totally misunderstood. Fonet was one that it was our biggest winner in 2019, and also a name that we had on Sum Zero, which is a fairly easy example to talk through. FONET in Turkey. Fonet is the largest hospital system software provider in Turkey, so it's the Cerner of Turkey, you can say. Uh-huh. Certainly, I'm sure, a less sophisticated version. We got involved in early 2019. I met with them a couple of times in Ankara and was able to meet with the family management there. At the time, they had zero English language reporting, no English speaking IR personnel. The BICS classification was wrong. There was zero sell side research coverage, no company IR presentation. And funny enough, so et means meet in Turkish. And when we first spoke with a couple of local brokers about the company in Turkey, two of them said something like, "Oh, Fonet, yeah, that's a meat producer, right?" This is the Cerner of Turkey, right? It's like one of the most beloved, you know, highest multiple business types in the world. We first invested, it was about 2x EV to EBITDA. And Cerner, I think, was at 24 times, and that's similar to the median globally for HIMSS providers. It was a case where there wasn't a lot of structuring that needed, really any. We were able to work with the family management to encourage them to report in English and fix all of those deficiencies in terms of reporting and IR that I just mentioned. And it fairly quickly sort of achieved a pretty significant re-rating. It's interesting having those two types of plays, the holdcos and the streamlined pure discovery activism plays. It's definitely been the latter that's been more lucrative in the last 10 years.
Let's end with some of the currency risks, just to frame how you think about that. Do you hedge, or do you have a hurdle rate that's high enough so that, you know, maybe the currency aspect of the thesis isn't going to drown the merits of the investment?
Yeah. So we, I would say, have learned from our mistakes, you know, since beginning our careers in these markets. And I definitely, in retrospect, view our lack of hedging in the early years as being a mistake to some degree, because, you know, we really want to concentrate that signal to the noise of the activism and with these companies we're investing in. You don't want a commodity or interest rate or currencies to really drive your outcome. And certainly our drawdown periods have been historically driven by currency. So we actually in 2019 started hedging currency directly selectively in markets where we view them as being perennially fragile currencies. So Turkey is one example where we've been fully hedged using futures, and certainly gotten paid to do that in the last few years. We have also invested primarily in net exporting businesses, but in these inefficient markets, we find that often doesn't really protect you in the kind of quarter to quarter type timeframe. We've also started shorting country ETFs based on a certain portion of the country and currency betas that we want to pull out from the exposures. So generally we're pulling out, you know, 20 to 50% of the country and currency betas of our larger tier country exposures. And that's because, you know, again, the returns are driven by the bottom-up stock selection and the activism. And we just don't, if we end up with a few ideas in Korea or Turkey, you know, et cetera, we really don't want the portfolio to be driven in any given period by currency or macro exposure. So that's what we've done for the last a little over a year at this point.
Got it. How diversified is your book typically?
You know, we are fairly diversified at the country level because we've find these opportunities from markets from Sri Lanka to Denmark with these smaller cap family owned businesses. So we do take advantage of that country diversification. We tend to hold 15 to 25 stocks, and it's been kind of at the lower end of that range. We love concentration. But at the country level, we've still been able to be in about kind of 12 to 17 countries, So that a lot of markets will have just one name at a given period of time. And that's certainly helpful in terms of offsetting, you know, volatility in a nonetheless concentrated portfolio. And we've actually had similar to even lower vol than the indices, even though we're much more concentrated in the indices, and we've had, you know, dramatically lower downside vol since inception.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen your returns. They obviously speak for themselves, especially relative to the MSCI EM index. But Ben, this is great. I feel like I've learned a lot about your way of thinking and approaching emerging markets. And you know, I feel like some of the stuff you've talked about feels like low-hanging fruit that you think you wouldn't have to convince companies to do at all. But that's clearly part of the opportunity. You know, hopefully we'll be seeing more of your work on SumZero and you know, again, good luck with the new fund. I think it's all very exciting.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Divya. Appreciate it.
That is all we have for you today. Thank you for listening. Goes to show there is value waiting to be discovered in the most unlikely places. Just takes a careful eye and lots of airline miles to find it. If you're a SumZero member, you can read Ben's research on ShareSpa, Phonet, and others on SumZero. If you are an allocator with SumZero's Cap Intro program, you can find Miri Capital Management listed on the platform. Lastly, if you are an individual investor interested in joining the SumZero community, please reach out to access@sumzero.com to learn more about our options for you. Thanks again. We hope you learned something. Have a great rest of your day.